This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
There's a college in the foothills of the Adirondack Mountains of New York whose culinary program has grown to the point where they had to leave the campus and open up a restaurant downtown.
This has an extra advantage of really bringing the college into more of a connection to the community.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from the president of SUNY Adirondack about Seasoned, a culinary experience located right in the middle of town. We'll also learn how archaeologists are studying sound and how archaeoacoustics combined with other research can provide a more holistic understanding of the past. And we'll spend an academic minute exploring the stigma of being single. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. SUNY Adirondack in Queensbury, New York, has opened a new student-run restaurant in the nearby city of Glens Falls. The eatery is called Seasoned and opened to the public last month. The project is part of the college's growing culinary arts program and will be open on select evenings during the week. The Best of Our Knowledge's Lucas Willard reports on this new endeavor from my alma mater.
It's not the school's first student-run restaurant, but college president Christine Duffy says the new location will allow for more opportunities for students.
Our last location was just off-site of the campus, and the restaurant capacity was just about 60, and that would be at full capacity. We had already started running out of space a couple years ago, trying to figure out what would we do next, and part of that is the popularity of the program, and of course, it's such a major workforce training driver given our location in a large hospitality and tourism region. So, and the other disadvantage we had was the restaurant and the kitchen were also the classroom. So you could only run one course at a time because you're doing all of those things together in the same space. So the opportunity when it arose to consider some sort of location downtown almost 2 years ago now, was not only a great opportunity for us to expand the footprint of the space and expand the program, but of course this has an extra advantage of really being part of the city of Glens Falls and bringing the college into more of a connection to the community. So it kind of was a win-win in a variety of ways.
And for somebody who's not very familiar with downtown Glens Falls, it's very walkable. Why was a downtown location, as opposed to a location you have to drive to, a factor in the decision-making for the new location?
Well, first of all, Glens Falls has been going through its own revitalization for the past several years. And so to be part of that kind of new energy and excitement about bringing new businesses downtown would allow us to connect with also some of the other restaurants and the hotels downtown for our students to have their internships, because even though they're getting practical experience with us during their program and their classes, we also expect that they're going to have their own internship experience at another site so that they obviously can see different procedures and different environments. So having direct access within walking distance of our facility, we think would also be an advantage for the students. And of course, you know, anytime you have residents and, you know, employees that are working downtown coming into our facility, interacting with our students, it also gives us a chance to be able to offer other opportunities while we're in downtown. You know, there's about 3,000 employees on a given day that are working right in the downtown space. So just from a customer base, of course, we have more access to people coming into our facilities, giving our students a variety of customers to work with, and also being able to maybe provide other types of education and training. We have two classrooms in this new building, so we can, when it's not being used for the culinary program, we might be able to use those classrooms to offer continuing ed or professional development opportunities for the employees of downtown and certainly the residents. So, you know, there's of course, connection with the city. There's it's walkable, meaning people can access us much easier both during the day and the evening. And the more people that are downtown either to visit us or other entities, it just grows businesses around us as well. So it's also an economic development project.
So in addition to cooking the food and planning the menu, what other work is going into this program and running a restaurant? What skills are going to be taught?
one thing that we've added, although it's still related to cooking, is that we also did not have a separate baking kitchen. And of course, baking and pastry art and the rise of, you know, of course, TV shows that promote baking, we now have an opportunity. We have a separate baking kitchen, so students are going to be able to take some advanced courses in the pastry arts. Students also learn about managing the staff. So, you know, there are rotations where students are learning about, you know, dining room management, design, also farm to table, and also understanding dietary needs, the chemistry of, you know, how to prepare some really unique types of sauces and things like that. Our culinary students have been involved with other businesses that are producing beverages and are learning about how to create flavor. So they, of course, are learning the multiple ways in which restaurants are managed and restaurants are serving. Certainly customer service in general is a skill that our students are gaining from the work that they're doing.
As for now, I understand that the restaurant will be open on Wednesday and Thursday nights. Is there any plan to expand this schedule in the future?
Yeah, I mean, we want to get through this first year and work out some of the bumps. That, you know, remember, it's student-run, which means that there's, you know, the students are learning and they're applying their learning in the same semester. So some of the ability to stay open on other nights is based on students and having enough students to be able to work those shifts. So it's not a restaurant in the fact that you go out and hire people and come in. So it's a little bit different. So right now we're focused on getting opened, and also being able to consider down the road next year as we expand the program, we might have more sections of students, which would allow us to be open more nights of the week. But in the meantime, what we also intend to do is have other types of events that are more community education. So, for example, things like pairing nights where we invite, you know, community members to sign up for classes that are not necessarily pursuing a degree with us but just might have personal interest. So, you know, I've been hearing from community residents, you know, I'd love to come in and learn how to, you know, roll sushi or understand better how to pair, you know, wine with food. And so our chefs are also looking at ways to use the facility for other nights. It'll be open for special events and for special education and training programs.
For the best of our knowledge, I'm Lucas Willard.
Still to come, archaeologists are going beyond recreating the look of an ancient site. They want to know how it sounded. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. From museums and films to ancient ruins reimagined in modern art and animation, the majority of reconstructions of past societies have focused on illustrating visually how individuals observed their environment and navigated through it. As a global community, one key sense in reconstructing the past has been consistently ignored: sound. From the podcast Postcards from the Road, Elizabeth Hill explores how archaeologists are diving into the physics of sound and how their work with the New York Department of Environmental Conservation is bringing the past to life by constructing soundscapes.
The topic of sound has been discussed at the theoretical level in phenomenology, which is the study of structures of consciousness as experienced from the first-person point of view. However, there's a growing field beginning to explore sound at the site level. Archaeologist Christy Primo works as an environmental analyst with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Primo has been working with archaeologist David Witt, the Indian Nations Affairs Coordinator for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. to expound on this practical exploration of sound through archaeoacoustics.
Archaeoacoustics is the study of sound in archaeology. Our research particularly focuses on sound at the landscape scale, although you can also study archaeoacoustics of a specific site or of an artifact.
The pair's research was published in the 2017 Spring Journal of Archaeological Science. Primo says they approached the project as a contextual experience of space and auditory perception as one of the ways in which people make sense of their world.
Well, this all started out as something we were working on at work as part of environmental review that we have to do at DEC. So we began by creating a Excel spreadsheet that did linear sound profiles from one point to another along a straight line path. And from there, Dave had actually created that one on his own. He came to me and approached me to see if we could get this into GIS to kind of create a 3D model. And both being archaeologists, we wanted to apply this to the past as well as to the present. This is a tool that you could use to model the sound anywhere, because sound physics behaves the same in the past as it does now.
What is GIS and how does it work?
So GIS stands for Geographic Information Systems, and it's a type of software that you use to display environmental data. It's kind of a cross between a relational database like Microsoft Access and Google Earth. And so what we have done is we've created a program that can model the way that sound spreads throughout a landscape in 3D. You can figure out how sound would have been experienced by a listener at any point in the landscape.
Primo and DeWitt's research takes us to the Chaco Canyon in New Mexico, home of the Anasazi or ancestral Puebloan people.
Chaco Canyon is, I'm thinking in metric, it's about 12 kilometer long, pretty shallow canyon. The cliffs only rise about 100 or so feet, 33 meters or so. It's pretty wide. From wall to wall, it ranges in between 1 mile to 4 miles, so about maybe 1.5 kilometers to 4 kilometers wide. It's got a series of erosional gullies coming in from either side. There's a giant butte right in the middle that's called Fajada Butte. There's not a lot of plant life there anymore. A lot of that was impacted by a erosional downcutting event that took place in the past 100 years or so, where the river cut down through its bank. It's pretty dusty. There's a lot of just dry grass that's in the area. There's some cottonwood trees that are in the gully itself. But it's pretty stark.
Primo highlights the variables used in the GIS mapping process.
These are 7 variables, and then, as Dave mentioned, the elevation data set, and then you need to input where your source of the sound is located, or you can have multiple sound sources. For the variables, there's 2 different categories. There's the environmental data and the data about the sound source itself. For the environmental data, you would need to have the temperature of the air and the percent of relative humidity, because that affects how the sound spreads in all of the sound physics calculations. You'd also need to know what the ambient sound pressure is, so what the levels of sound are at the area that you're studying. Then the second group is the source of the sound, and those include the height of the sound source, the sound pressure level of the source, which is measured in decibels, the distance at which you measured the sound source, and the frequency of the source.
And when it comes to that environmental data, you know, climate change is definitely an aspect. One of the things about Chaco Canyon is that there's a good record of scientists looking at the paleoclimate and trying to reconstruct it. So we were able to look at that and pretty confidently use historical baseline data as a proxy for what the climate was 1,000 years ago. We can look at tree rings, we can look at pack rat middens, erosional processes, all these various other things that show that the climate generally has been stable within that time period.
But I was curious about how Primo and Witt were compensating for these structural changes over the years, and how it might shape future research.
Our tool basically models how sound spreads over the landscape that's put into it via a digital elevation model. So it's as accurate as that baseline data we put into it. So as a test for our technology, we were able to input all these things. We used a modern surface of Chaco Canyon. As we go back to it and keep working on this project, what we want to do is use reconstructed surfaces. And this is something that people have been working on in Chaco, where they've actually gone and modeled the height and the extent of these great houses. So we're hopefully going to be bringing in those models into this to create a more accurate representation of the surface back at that time. And with Chaco Canyon specifically, back in the 1940s, there was a major event where a specific cliff face collapsed. And that's a perfect example of what type of erosional processes would take place. Obviously, that collapse affects our modeling. So what we want to do is take this digital elevation model we have of the terrain and correct it, quote unquote, so that we could take into account the fact that this cliff face was present 1,000 years ago.
The implementations are vast, and using archaeoacoustics combined with other archaeological research could provide a more holistic understanding of the past.
For an educational aspect, I really feel strongly that this helps people just connect more strongly and more closely to the lived experiences of people that were in the past. I guess that's a bit axiomatic, but when we're talking about Chaco Canyon, it's a pretty desolate location. It's at the end of about a 20-mile corrugated dirt road. People don't go there just for fun, really. They go there for the environmental and educational aspects of the trip. So in a situation like that, we could easily see our tool being used within a historical interpretation of what was going on, where we could help point out, like, if you stand in this location, if you were there 1,000 years ago, you would have heard these sounds coming from certain locations. People go there today and it's pretty quiet. You hear the wind blowing through the grass and occasional plane flying overhead. But other than that, it's pretty quiet out there. And that's not how it was in 1100 AD. It was a very busy place at that time.
It's just like any other place that you'd have a bunch of people and animals and sounds and ceremonies and all of those things. And these could all be worked into a tourism type experience through kiosks, through audio tours, and that type of interpretive material.
That brings up a project we've been working with some colleagues of ours over in the University of Nebraska over in Lincoln, where we're looking at recreating the Mayan city of Copan in a computer application where people can go and walk through it. And as part of it, these structures are being recreated in 3D representation, and you can put on your goggles and explore it. But it would also tie in our sound, because we're able to map where certain sounds would be heard as you're walking through that landscape.
So that kind of brings in virtual reality modeling, as well as back to your question about how the landscape has changed, because now in this future project we have, we are actually working with a reconstructed past landscape instead of just putting a past reconstruction on a modern landscape.
Are there any more projects in the near future?
We've had some conversations with other researchers. We were looking at working with a former classmate of mine at UB. She looks at early medieval Irish landscapes. And part of what we were talking about doing together was using sound as a way to hypothesize if the wealthier people, the wealthier class, actually had situated their homes in relationship with others, or perhaps out of sound from others so that they got more quiet. We just were tossing a bunch of ideas around that. And we have a few other concepts that we're teasing out.
Yeah, we've discussed doing something with the War of 1812 for more of a historical aspect. And we're also working on expanding the tools themselves to be able to do more things. So what would the impact be of thick vegetation like you'd have in a jungle type situation? Or what would the impact be if you had multiple loud sound sources occurring at different points in the landscape in the same time? Because sound doesn't just layer up. You can't just add two pieces of sound together. You have to do it logarithmically. So that's something that we would need the software to help us with.
In the time since Postcard's interview with David Witt and Christy Primo, the pair have continued working with Assistant Professor of Anthropology Heather Richards Rosetto of the University of Lincoln, Nebraska, and one of her former grad students, Graham Goodwin, to tie their modeling with their virtual reality constructions. Witt and Primo were able to create a walkthrough of the Acropolis of Copan in Honduras, illustrating how sounds would have been experienced as one walked through a ritual procession. This was just a video, not something that anyone could have controlled, and not something that one could experience with VR goggles. But it's a start. The pair have also done some follow-up work on Chaco Canyon, which was presented at the European Association of Archaeologists in Barcelona. There they highlighted how Chacoan elites could have manipulated the unique soundscape of the canyon for political purposes. Witt and Primo are now working with another colleague, Jennifer Schaefer Foster, to explore how sound could have played a role in the reinterpretation and reuse of sites in the Irish landscape.
That report comes from Elizabeth Hill, producer and host of the podcast Postcards from the Road. You can find all episodes of that podcast, along with all episodes of The Best of Our Knowledge, at wamcpodcasts.org. People who don't get married are used to being talked about as they get older, but that stigma against singles may finally be fading, and that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The stigmas against staying single are breaking down. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities, and today on the Academic Minute, Hilda Speicher, professor of psychology at Albertus Magnus College, determines that as time goes on, being unhitched is becoming easier.
Cultural norms pressure adults to marry and are enforced by stigmatizing single adults. Our study compared the stigmatizing attitudes expressed in research conducted in 1997 to attitudes expressed using the same research materials over a decade later. It was expected that there would no longer be stigma associated with being single. College students evaluated a fictional character, Lee, for whom we provided a brief biographical sketch and varied gender and marital status. All other aspects of the biographical sketch were identical. Lee was evaluated on morality and social competence, and on whether single Lee should marry, wants to marry, and is likely to marry. Respondents were also asked if remaining single is abnormal. Results show a large majority of each sample believed remaining single is not abnormal. However, the percentage decreased. In 1997, evaluations of Lee showed more negative attitudes toward singles compared to the recent sample. Also, gender stereotypes were endorsed. For both samples, female Lee was generally evaluated more positively. And in the recent sample, being single adversely impacted social competence ratings for female Lee, but not male Lee. This latter finding suggests stigma still exists in being single, but only for females.
That was Hilda Speicher of Albertus Magnus College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.